Ezekiel 4 and 5. And it'd be good, you're probably going to want to keep it open all the way through this evening. And as we read it through, I'm not going to read it through per se. We're going to work through little bit by little bit. Because what's before us this evening, is one of many judgment passages within Ezekiel. But what's distinctive about this particular one compared to others is that it's not just an announcement by a prophet, but the prophet acts out the judgment. And so I thought we would have the judgment acted out as we go through the passage this evening. So my normal victim, Dan, is going to help me with this in a bit. And we're going to try and act out as we go through the passage. As we're sort of reading, we're going to see it as well, because it's meant to be seen. It's meant to be felt. It's not just meant to be heard. People in exile were seeing what Ezekiel was doing. Ezekiel 4 and 5 begins with Ezekiel being asked, verse 1, to take a clay tablet. It's as close as I could get to a clay tablet, a brick. And on it, he's to draw the city of Jerusalem. So here's Jerusalem, and here's the little houses all over here, and here's the wall as it was, and here's the temple here. So he draws on this clay tablet here, like this. You see Jerusalem? That's what's happening. And then, verse 2, he's to lay siege to it. So he's erect siege works and put battering rams around it. So here we go. We've got a little kind of siege works and a battering ram. And he's to lay some ramps up against it, and a few soldiers just around, just to keep going. It's like some kind of old soldier thing. So here he is, the battering rams around it, siege works are in place. Then Ezekiel's to take an iron pan, like this. You there? Everyone there? And he's to place it as an iron wall between himself and the city. Come on up, Dan. Dan is now playing the role of Ezekiel, and Ezekiel is playing the role of who? God. So take the pan, put yourself between there and there. Move, not in front of me, that's right. And you're now going to turn your face towards it, okay? You may want to get on the table, go for it. It's going to happen at some point tonight.
Strong table.
Yeah, it is, come on. Okay, put your face down. It's all right, it was just his feet. There we go, like that. There we go. So there we are. And Ezekiel at this point is representing Yahweh, and where previously there had been no barrier between Yahweh and Jerusalem, now there was an impenetrable wall. And Yahweh has set his face towards them in judgment. And the siege that would overcome the city was not as a result of some foreign army randomly attacking and laying siege towards it. Jerusalem would be under siege as a direct consequence of Yahweh's judgment. And we have to grasp the significance of that. The people listening to this, seeing this, are in exile in Babylon. And their hope is in Jerusalem, that brick. Because Jerusalem for them represents the geographical, the political, the spiritual link with the glorious past of Israel and the place where Yahweh dwells. And whilst Jerusalem remains in their mind, there is hope of return. God's city still stands. But now they begin to hear what in their minds was unthinkable: Jerusalem will be destroyed. And more than that, God himself, Yahweh, is behind it. He's turning his face towards it in judgment. Their hope was beginning to crumble. Things were getting seriously bad, but the sign does not end there. Verses 4 to 8, Ezekiel is then told to lay on his left side. Pardon? You're not... Head the other way. Head the other way.
We practiced this beforehand. It's all right.
Don't tell my wife. So he's now on his left side. And we read he's to put the sin of the house of Israel on himself. Now, what's being described here is not Ezekiel bearing the sin as some kind of substitutionary sacrifice, like on the cross. No, he's representing the guilt of the entire covenant community of Israel. And he's to lie there for 390 days, representing 390 years of the sin of the people. And 390 is not a random number. It's roughly the period from when Solomon's temple was complete to when the people were sent to exile. Because it was from the end of Solomon's reign, or midway through his reign, that the people started to turn from the Lord. And each king that then followed Solomon, bar a couple, were successively worse than their predecessor. So from Solomon onwards, it was just a spiral downwards into sin, and further away from God's purposes. It was the accumulation of sin over that period that Ezekiel is to put on. He's to symbolize by laying on his left side for 390 days. And at this point, the focus is on Judah, the southern kingdom. Although the house of Israel and the house of Judah is spoken of in this passage, within Ezekiel, they're interchangeable terms. They just represent Judah. They represent where Jerusalem was. They represent the southern kingdom. Because by this time, the other 11 or 10 tribes of the northern kingdom have been exiled, destroyed. They're no more to be. All that left is Judah, effectively one tribe, and now they are exiled. And so Ezekiel, having spent 390 days on his left side, presumably he did not spend all day like that, just part of the day, was to then to turn to his right side. And he's on his right side for 40 days. See verse 6? And of course, 40 days is represented 40 years. 40 years is significant. It was the period that Israel spent in the desert, in the wilderness, in Exodus, waiting for the rebellious generation to die. And this exilic generation is now condemned to a similar fate for the nation's long history of sin. Now, in practice, it will be more like 70 years, but of course, 40 is the symbolic number of judgment. Although, to be fair, there are signs that would suggest that the last people to be exiled and to the time when the first people began to leave was actually only 40 years. But the significance doesn't change. They're going to be judged for that period until that exilic generation has been wiped out. And so verse 7, get ready, Dan. He's to turn his face towards Jerusalem. And with his bare arm, now aimed at Jerusalem, representing God, he's to prophesy against her. And then Ezekiel is tied up, like this, probably a little bit tighter. Mind your neck, don't do that. Your mum's watching. He's tied up. In order to make clear, this cannot change. Jerusalem is under God's judgment. Nothing can be done about what is to happen. And then the next act begins, verse 9 to 17. And now Ezekiel is called to eat specific foods during the time he lies on his side. You can sit up a bit at this point, I think. Be a little bit awkward otherwise. And he's to eat, as it were, you don't literally have to eat it, it's all right, is to wheat, which is effectively siege food, rations. And he's representing that which is happening in this city down here. But just in case the exiles think they are safe, Ezekiel is called to cook food on human poo, verse 12, which would mean that the food was defiled. So verse 13, we read, the Lord said, in this way the people of Israel will eat defiled food among the nations where I will drive them. They will be a defiled people, the very opposite to that which the Lord has called them to be. Now, at this point, Ezekiel protests. I mean, lying on your side for 430 days is one thing, but eating food cooked on human poo is just another thing altogether. And Ezekiel protests on the basis that, verse 14, he has never defiled himself. From my youth until now, I've never eaten anything found dead or torn by wild animals. No unclean meat has ever entered my mouth. And the Lord hears his cry and allows him to cook on cow poo instead. Now, it might just be a hint at this point that among the exilic people, there'll be those like Ezekiel who will remain pure and faithful to the Lord. But overall, the picture is bleak. See verses 16 and 17. In Jerusalem, they'll become anxious and in despair. They'll be appalled at the sight of each other and will waste away because of their sin. Jerusalem will be laid to bear. It was the end of the exiles' hope. God's judgment would weigh heavily upon them. And at this point, the interval comes, the curtain comes down, they go for their little ice creams and snacks, then they come back for the second half. Chapter 5, verses 1 to 4, the drama continues. And it's a one-act drama, as it were, from verse 5 to the end. He's going to explain what he means in these four verses. But in this little drama, verse 1 to 4, we see Ezekiel is to take a sharp sword. And he uses it as a barber's razor to shave his head and beard. And in Jewish culture, this would be an act of great shame and humiliation. Much to the same it is tonight. See, it's no small thing is Ezekiel's doing, to shave your head and your beard. In other words, God's people were going to be humiliated. Nothing left. Jerusalem will have gone. There'll be a people in exile. To the world, they will look like a shamed nation. But it gets worse. Ezekiel is then to carefully take a set of scales, and he is to divide up the hair from his head. Obviously, I couldn't get down to cut his own hair, so I cut mine. It's all right, Dan. It was clean. And it's to put it in the scales, and it's to symbolize this, that God's judgment is not delivered in a haphazard fashion. It's not random, but it's meticulously measured and meted out exactly. So Ezekiel takes up the hair at the end of 430 days, takes a third of the hair, rid of the food for now, and with a third of the hair, he is to, you can't do this bit, burn it inside the city. Presumably he's acting it out on the model here. So put on the city there. A third of the hair is now burnt up. And it will represent a third of who will die within the city walls. Then he's to take another third, and he's to strike it with a sword all around the city. That's it. And the hair, all the way around. That's it, great. All the way around the city. And it's representing those who will die outside the city. Then he's to take another third and scatter it in the wind. And it represents those who are sent into exile. But a few hairs, verse 3, are kept back. And Ezekiel tucks them into the fold of his cloak. Keep them for later. Representing the remnant. But even they won't be safe. Some of them will also face judgment and be thrown into the fire. And it's a very graphic, detailed account. You can sit back down now, Dan. Because verses 5 to 10, thank you very much, now explain these first four announcements to us. And the first announcement in verses 5 to 10, we begin to see why God has turned his face against his beloved city and people. See verse 5, Jerusalem and its people were meant to be the center of the nations. And instead, verse 6, they'd rejected God's word. They rebelled against him worse than all the other nations. See, verse 7, you've been more unruly than the nations around you. You've not followed my decrees or kept my laws. In fact, you've not even conformed to the standard of the nations around you. See, Jerusalem and its people were supposed to be a light to the nations that surrounded them. They were to be at the center. But instead, they'd led the nations further into darkness. They'd worshipped, verse 9, detestable idols, and all that had come with it, at its worst, child sacrifices. And because of their rebellion, the Lord will inflict, verse 8, punishment on them. He'll judge them in the sight of the very nations they were to have been a witness to. And the Lord, verses 9 to 10, will visit his people with unprecedented hostility. The effects of his actions are described in the most horrifying terms, cannibalism. So verse 10, fathers will eat children and children will eat fathers. And the Lord, in effect, is giving them over to their desires. Oh, they wanted to sacrifice children. They wanted to be like the nations. And they will. The judgment will be horrific. And then we read verses 11 to 17, the second announcement. It confirms the judgment and further spells out why it is God is judging them. See, verse 11, it's not only that they've been more unruly and disobedient than the other nations. They've defiled Yahweh's sanctuary with vile images and detestable practices. And as such, he will not, verse 11, spare them. He will execute his decision. And he'll show no mercy and no pity and no compassion. And verse 12, the picture of the thirds is picked up and fleshed out. The first third will die of the plague, perish by famine within the city walls. The second third will fall by the sword outside the city. The last third will be scattered to the winds. And only then will judgment be complete. Will God's anger cease? Verse 13. And the Lord's acts of judgment are not a furious, arbitrary outpouring like I might do on my sons. No, God's acts of judgment on a rebellious people are intentionally designed to bring them to an acknowledgement of his presence, character, and claim on their lives. See the end of verse 13? They will know that I, the Lord, have spoken in my zeal, in my divine passion. See, his actions, the destruction of Jerusalem, the decimation of the population, has been driven by his passion, by his zeal. See, the Lord has not entered lightly into relationship with Israel. And so he cannot stand idly by while it is threatened by their behavior. And the intensity of his wrath at the defilement of his sanctuary and the rejection of his will arises out of his great depth of his covenant love. It is because he loves so deeply that he must respond so vigorously. His relationship with his people has been violated. And so verses 14 to 17 spell it out further. They bring it all to a head. He will send against them a number of calamities to fulfill his mission of death. There will be a ruin and a reproach, a warning and an object of horror to the nations around them, verse 15. For verse 16, he will shoot at them with deadly and destructive arrows of famine. He will send wild beasts against them, leaving them childless. Plagues and bloodshed will sweep through. The sword will be against them. And he's building up a picture of all the curses that he had mentioned and told them about in Leviticus 26. See, in Leviticus 26, where he details the law, he says to them, if you obey me, I'll bless you. If you disobey me, I will curse you. And all these curses that we read of in these two chapters come from Leviticus 26. They're all part of his covenant purposes, all part of his covenant word, his relationship with his people. For he said if they disobeyed, he would bring such curses on them. Now he has. I, the Lord, have spoken. It will happen just as he warned, just as he declared. They may have been unfaithful, but he has been utterly faithful to his word and his covenant. These two chapters are striking pictures of judgment. I'm going to pause there just in case there are any questions before we think about it for ourselves. Anything anyone wants to think about, ponder? Makes sense? We're there?
This is directed to the people who are in exile.
Yep. So Ezekiel is talking to those in exile by the rivers of Babylon, and he is speaking these words of destruction of Jerusalem, because their whole hope is built on Jerusalem. And here they are hearing now, this will be destroyed. So don't forget, you've got Jeremiah preaching in Jerusalem to them. Ezekiel is to the exiles, and he's warning them, and we're going to read a bit later on, that they hear that Jerusalem has been destroyed, and they hear how God's glory has left the temple. But for now, they're being told it's going to happen, and it will be a complete disaster for them, because their whole hope is built on Jerusalem, where God lives, where the temple was.
In case you use the word Yahweh a few times.
If you notice in Ezekiel 4 and 5, where the word Lord is mentioned, it's in capital letters. And that is Yahweh's God's name. It's revealed to us in Exodus 33. It speaks of his covenant name, his faithfulness to his people. And so it's the name that the Jews would have used, or is used often of him, and speaking, particularly when he's thinking of his relationship with his people, of his covenant, his promises to them. Thank you. Anything else? It's quite a somber picture, isn't it? So what about us then? How does it apply to us? I think four ways. Firstly, the horrific nature of judgment. What's so striking, isn't it, about these announcements is just how horrific it is. I mean, we're not left in any doubt about what will happen. We're not left wondering whether this will be just a kind of slap on the wrist. No, to face a judgment of the living God is a serious, horrific thing. And yet so often, we sanitize it. We kind of make it sound like a credible alternative to being saved. I think it was Spurgeon that said every time he spoke of hell, he had a tear in his eye. I wonder whether every time we share the gospel, we have a tear in our eye when we speak of God's judgment. And I imagine if you're anything like me, you don't. Because either we quickly gloss over the part of judgment, or we play down the consequences so much that it doesn't sound so bad. But the language here is one of utter horror. I'll make you a ruin and reproach, a warning. There'll be famine and the sword and wild animals and childlessness and plagues and destructive arrows. This is not a slap wrist. This is not a kind of time out on the step. And of course, the reality of hell is far worse. Eternal separation in a place where there is no good and no joy, and all good things are removed. So you imagine all of these things here, famine and sword and destructive arrows, combined with the removal of all good, common grace, and lasting not for 40 years, but for eternity, and we're still only beginning to get a taste of what hell will be like. See, do we spell out the horrific nature of judgment? Or have we sanitized it so much that it sounds like a Hollywood movie? And the truth is, you only have to look to the cross, don't you? To see the seriousness of God's judgment, the seriousness of his wrath. He sent his son so that we didn't have to face it. If it was not that serious, if it was not that horrific, God would not have needed to send his only beloved son. Let's not sanitize judgment. Ezekiel didn't, and we mustn't. But the second thing that's striking in these passages is this, isn't it? The faithfulness of God to his covenant. The faithfulness of God to his covenant. See, the people were utterly unfaithful. They'd broken their side of the covenant, that promise to be God's people, to obey his laws. But God had not broken his side. That of to be their God. So when the people came out of Egypt and Moses gave them the law, part of the law were the blessings and the curses, as we mentioned. If they obeyed God, he would bless them. If they disobeyed, he would curse them. And what is striking in these passages, as I said, is if you read Leviticus 26 and you read Deuteronomy chapter 28, you would find that most of the acts of judgment contained there, from cannibalism to the plagues, to the famines, to the wild beasts, to childlessness, none of it is new. All is part of the covenant. And so when God acts in judgment, he's not acting outside of the covenant. He's not acting outside of being their God. He is fulfilling faithfully what he's revealed. And the reason he does so is because of his zeal, his divine passion for his people. See, the reason that its judgment is so horrific is because of the depth of love God has for his people. The reason for the curses was not just to punish their sin, although that's certainly part of it. It's in order to draw them back to himself. Which is why I take it a number of times we're told that it's the sovereign Lord, it's Yahweh who is acting in this way against the people. He wants them to know it's him acting against them so that they may repent and come back to him. And he is faithful to his covenant still today. See, part of his promises to us, isn't it? Is that he will still judge. He promises that Jesus will come again and Jesus will judge all. And Ezekiel chapter 4 to 5 reveals he is utterly faithful to his word. What he says, he does. And we're meant to read this and we're meant to hear the warning that God will judge and he will ultimately judge the people of Israel in order that the people would come back to him. And we're meant to look at this, and we're meant to see the judgment, and we're meant to hear the warning, and we're meant to know that God is faithful to his word, and therefore we're meant to know that judgment is coming, and we're meant to think of verses like 2 Peter 3, that God is currently being patient to give people time to respond to him, but he is coming. And of course that spurs us on to evangelism. It spurs us on to make a decision to follow Christ if we don't know him. But knowing judgment is coming also spurs us on to keep going. Because we know there will be a day when all wrongs are righted, when injustices now will be made just, and that through judgment, purification will happen. All sin will be removed. And there will be a time when God will live perfectly with his people. That's the hope of Ezekiel 4 and 5. That's the hope of the remnant to live in the New Jerusalem. That's our hope. That's what judgment brings. That's what we will become. And God is utterly faithful to his word. And seeing and knowing that he is faithful to his covenant in Ezekiel 4 and 5 assures us that he is utterly faithful to his covenant and promises to us today. It's a simple point, but a profound one in terms of the implications for us. So the faithfulness of God to his covenant. Thirdly, those who have presumed upon the light of God's grace must reckon with the darkness of his fury. That is, God's people must never just view God from one side, must never just view God as Saviour, and forget he is the judge. See, the people in Ezekiel's day, sitting there in Babylon, presumed he would never judge them. In the sense, he would never judge Jerusalem. Okay, they'd experienced the exile, but they thought that was the end. They kind of thought they had kind of been kept safe. And they never thought he would judge Jerusalem. That's what's shocking about this passage, is that Jerusalem, God's city, will be destroyed. Because God will not condone infidelity or rebellion or wickedness or abominations. He won't condone it by the nations, and he certainly won't condone it by his own people. And to forget that God is judge may leave one tempted to rebel, thinking, hey, do you know what? He will save after all. It's to presume upon his grace. But God watches over his covenant with passion. There's a zeal for his people. Those who claim to be his people may not exchange him for another God without cost, without arousing his jealousy, without arousing his passion. And so the Lord will act to correct. Just as he did for his people then, he will do the same for his people today. So you think of the words in Hebrews 12. It speaks of God disciplining his people, those he loves. See, God will not leave his people in sin. He will correct. He'll bring about judgment in that sense, corrective discipline. And often it's easy to only see this as kind of you look back. But every time we're faced with a difficult situation, I think it's right to ask the question, is this God's discipline? Is this God's judgment on us? So here's a question. We're facing serious financial challenges as a church after years of substantial blessing. And the question is this. Is this part of God's discipline in us? We heard this morning of all the good things, and there are many good things about us as a church, of God's work amongst us. But maybe this challenge facing us is part of God's discipline on us. Maybe it's because we've not been dependent enough on Him. Maybe we have lacked in prayerfulness. Maybe we've become too proud, too confident in our own ability. Too confident in the good things. And we stop depending on Him. Now, I cannot say definitively this is God's discipline on us, God's judgment on us. But neither can I say definitively it isn't. And so at these times, you have to examine our hearts. And we have to ask the question, are we zealous for the Lord as we could be individually and as a church? Are we as dependent on Him as we could be? Are we as prayerful as we could be? Are we being sacrificial in all that we do, or are we holding back? See, we must not presume just because we're saved, just because we've experienced His grace and His blessing, He will not discipline us. He judged His people. He destroyed Jerusalem, His holy city, because God will do what is necessary for the good of His people and for the glory of His name. And He'll do the same today as He did then. Do not presume upon His grace. And then fourthly this, hope in the midst of judgment. Contained in Ezekiel 4 and 5 are three rays of hope. Firstly, 430 days, 390 plus 40. 430 days is how long Ezekiel had to lie. But 430 was also the number of years that Israel was enslaved to Egypt. And a Jew reading this would have known that. They'd have known all that had happened in that period. But more significantly, they would have known what had happened in the 430th year. They were saved. God heard their cry and remembered His covenant, and He rescued them. And in the same way, He promises at the end of the 40 years, He will save them again. He'll restore them. As we've seen in our studies of Nehemiah and Haggai and Esther, He will save. And then we see another ray of hope in the sign act of hair. There were a few who were tucked away in the fold of Ezekiel's robe. And there would be a remnant. There would be some who He would save. God would have a remnant people. And from that remnant will come a Messiah, a Savior. Not just for the few, but for the many, for all who would believe in Him. See, judgment will come, but salvation is also available. The Lord will save. And then the last ray of hope comes in the use of Leviticus. As we've seen, all the judgments in these two chapters are lifted from Leviticus 26. And of course, the Jews reading this would have known how Leviticus 26 ended. See, Leviticus 26, chapter 44 says this. Yet in spite of this, when they are in the land of their enemies, I will not reject them or abhor them, so as to destroy them completely, breaking my covenant with them. I am the Lord their God. See, as one writer commenting on these chapters says, the rainbow continues to shine through the gathering gloom. Salvation always follows judgment. That's the truth of the cross. God judges. He bears His wrath on Jesus. But flowing from that judgment comes salvation to all who believe. Just as we're called to speak the truth of judgment, to speak of its horrific nature, so we must never end there. We must always lead people to the salvation, the rainbow in the gloom, to the hope in the midst of judgment. So even in a passage like this, there is much hope, because the God we serve is a merciful and gracious God who deems to save, who's mighty to save. And we're going to come to the table and remember that great salvation. Remember what it is Christ has done for us. Remember how he shed his blood and broke his body so that we may be saved.